I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Jesus, I am seeking your face because there are things in my life that need to be erased. And that can only happen with your grace. So don't leave me in this place of utter confusion, emotional seclusion, and painful disgrace. I'm led to believe in my heart of heart that one word from you will jumpstart the life you intended and destined for me. All I need is one word to set me free. And if it's the written word, then so be it. But please make it come alive in me.
Thank you. That was Anita Scott, my guest today on Spark My Muse. Thank you so much, Anita, for sharing that. And we'll be talking more about your work and what you're up to. But maybe you can introduce yourself so that my listeners know who you are and what you've been up to.
Sure. First, let me say thank you, Lisa. I'm over the top honored to be a guest on Spark My Muse. Absolutely thrilled. So as Lisa said, my name is Anita Scott, and I am a Texas native, born and raised in Dallas, and have lived here my entire life. And I'm actually a middle school teacher. So I'll expect some sympathy letters in my mail pretty soon. So I've been teaching middle school. I'm going into my fifth year. I have been an educator my entire life, even when I attempted to run away from education. Education tracked me down. It really, really did. But I come from a lineage of educators, and so I think I left footprints in the sand, even though I didn't try to. But that is me in a synopsis.
Yeah, and you see yourself living in Texas for the foreseeable future, but you are I found you through Tammy Perlmutter and the Mudroom.
Yes.
Yeah, and the Mudroom, and you are the poet in residence for that blog and that website.
Yeah. I am. Tammy and I connected via a conference last summer in Chicago, summer 2015. And I was able to be a part of a Chicago Slam poetry event. And it was amazing because at this event, you have over, 3,000, 4,000 people. And it was interesting that Tammy said she sought the Lord and prayed in order to be able to meet me at this event after I performed my poetry a day or two later. And we ended up by the will of God, we ended up connecting. And ever since then, we are poetry buddies and blog buddies. And it's absolutely amazing how this all came to be.
Wow. And so,
yeah.
Yeah, Tammy has been a friend of mine for several years, and I was able to actually stay over with the Jesus People community for a couple days, and it was so neat to be involved and just see how it works like that in that community. And she was a guest on my blog trying to explain what, I mean, people talk about community and just toss the word around, right? But when you actually live in community, when it can get really messy and you can't just walk away because you're living right next to people, you know, day in and day out. And she's been a really neat connectional point for so many people. And I said, you know, who do you think I should have on the show? She's like, Anita Scott, you get her on the show. Like, and so I was like, oh, okay. So I started looking around, and then I was just moved to tears. I love poetry, but I don't usually, I'm not like a crying person. Like, I love the arts, but I was just shaken. And I mean, like, what am I supposed to just turn that off? And I'm like, I have to get her on, you know? And I was wondering, maybe before we talk a little bit about your background, if you could read the one that actually got me to just sort of stop in my tracks. It was the one about creation.
Sure. Well, this particular poem is called All Seasons. And this was written, I guess, gosh, a few years ago, November of 2007. So here it is. Who knew that you were the breeze hiding behind the trees, playing hide and seek only to capture me? Who knew that you taught the eagle how to fly so I could learn how to soar? And who knew that you gave the sparrow its song so I could listen for dialogue between heaven and earth? Who knew that you gave the woodpecker its cadence so I could hear drum beats from heaven? Drum beats. And who knew that every night you watch the sunset and smile, and every morning you watch the sun rise, and it still brings tears to your eyes because beauty is a masquerade for your glory. So you stretch the sun rays to hide your face so we won't be consumed so soon. Instead, you allow us to feel the warmth of your grace, taking it all in day by day. But who knew day to day would sever a branch and cause the leaves in our fall and swallow up so in pain, and eventually the sun rays we would despise just from not knowing the truth from the lies? So now it would make sense to believe a lie because the truth is just story. So you knew to live with us was extremely mandatory, so you stayed and stayed with us intimately, showing us and how he represented you so matter-of-factly, not giving up on a people so satisfactorily consumed with nothingness. So you stayed and put a star side by side, show us our relationship with you. And then you bring the moon out every night with the brilliance from the sunlight to show us even when it's dark, you shine. And you remind us of your precious promise again and again by the banner of brilliant colors all huddled up all over each other in the sky with no end, just like your name. And who knew even after hearing your truth, we would still need your help. You knew, so you stayed and put your voice in the mouth of the sparrow, in the pattern of the buzzing bee, in the legs of the grasshopper, in the dancing wings of the hummingbird, in the quietness of the dew, resting atop the blade of a reed of grass, in the twinkle of each star, in the heart of each of your children. And who knew if we would only acknowledge you like nature does, we would know you. Who knew?
I don't even know how to follow that up at all. Just so speechless. Yeah, and I had to calm down on this end, or I would have been like, just breaking it up there. Oh, thank you so much. There's something about art that just pierces right through everything and just gets to the center of it. And so it makes me want to ask you, when did you start with poetry? How was it introduced into your life?
Great question. I'm number four of eight children, and my parents homeschooled all eight of us. Yes, they did. This is back in the 70s, 80s, before homeschooling was a big, you know, as big as it is now. And I, at some point in early on in my elementary school years, probably 8 or 9 years old, was given a journal by my mom. And I just began writing down my thoughts, and I considered my journal to actually, in all truth, to be like my best friend. Because I felt like that was the place where I could voice my opinion and not get pushback. I could voice my opinion and not be turned down. You know, I could voice my opinion and no one would say, wow, what made you think of that? And so over the course of years, though, my sisters and I were introduced to rap music, you know, hip hop. And absolutely fell in love with it. Fell in love with it, was intrigued with the idea that someone could convey their thought and their opinion in the form of a rhyme scheme. And so my brothers and sisters and I would, you know, rap music just blare through the house, and I'd walk around and I would learn the lyrics, and I was very proud of myself because I thought, wow, if they can do it, I can do it. And so I began going to my journal, and I wanted all of my thoughts to rhyme. I just wanted all of them to rhyme. And I wanted my prayers to rhyme. I wanted my tears to rhyme. I wanted my passion to rhyme. And so over the course of time, was introduced to the works of Langston Hughes, Nikki Giovanni, Maya Angelou, and absolutely was floored by their persistence to bring social injustice to a rhyme scheme. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to have a voice that addresses injustices. I want to have a voice that addresses the tears and the sorrows in my soul and someone else's. And so I just faithfully put my pen and my tears and my joy to the paper. And I just wanted the rhyme scheme to come out.
And then did you, as far as your spiritual life, and was mm-hmm. that also in the home as well? Were you raised in a Christian home?
Absolutely. I was raised in a Christian home. My father actually pastored for years. And so my father was the pastor. My mom was the administrator and the principal of the home school. It actually turned into a full blown Christian academy, and was raised in a Christian home with disciplines such as we would get together in our living room, have prayer time every morning, have devotions. Even in our school, you were expected to learn passages of scriptures at length. And you were expected to write reflections about those scriptures. How did those scriptures apply to your daily life? But in all truth, that was a practice, but the cultivation of the Holy Spirit actually living in my life did not take shape and form until I was in my mid to late 20s. When someone actually one day asked me, hey, how's your relationship with the Lord? And I remember giving a generous chuckle, like, how? Wow, like, what a question. That's interesting. And it sent me into a spiraling, upside down life of, are you trying to tell me that this God that I've been serving actually wants to be in relationship with me? I didn't know that. I mean, I knew I was serving him, and I was faithful to show up at church and, you know, open the church doors and lock the church doors and volunteer at youth services and, you know, go to camp and be a camp counselor and be on the worship team and be an usher. But not until my mid to late 20s did I know that this God that I was serving was not really asking me to serve him. He was asking me to love him in response to his love for me. And I'm still on that journey.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering, this might sound like a really odd question, but like, how were your parents okay with you singing rap? And like, how did that mesh with your Christian upbringing?
I'm so glad you asked. In all honesty, the only music that was allowed in our home was Christian music. Mm-hmm. So we were not exposed to like Tupac or Dr. Dre or
Public Enemy.
I'm clueless in that area. Someone might think you were not raised in America because you don't know all of the best 80s and 90s hip hop jams. Mm-hmm. And I don't. Mm. So Christian rap made its intro probably in the mid 80s with like D-Boy and Preachers in Disguise, parentheses PID. And when they were released, my brothers and sisters and I just had a heyday. We thought heaven had opened and had given us what we wanted, because all of our friends were listening to, I'll call it what everybody else calls it, secular rap. And we just felt like we were gypped. And when Christian rap came out, all we did, you know, this is back in the days of the tapes, you know, so we would just push play and rewind and play and rewind. And when the tape would end on one side, we would flip it over and push play. And all we did was listen to D-Boy, and Preachers in Disguise, and then Reverend Rhyme came out, and we thought now we were just as cool as everybody else. And so when I mentioned rap, it was because of the likes of those artists that came out and let Christians know, wow, no, we're cool too. yes.
I felt so funny because the later on, like when you go out into the non-Christian world, that must have been a real slap of reality, right?
Oh man, yes. I mean, we as a Christian family, and we were homeschooled. Right. Oh, like we were kind of like, I don't know, we were the.
It's almost like you're from another planet.
We were from another planet. Because, you know, every state has their public school district, mm-hmm. and their boundary lines. And so our friends would always say, oh, what school do you go to? And we mm-hmm. we're homeschooled.
Yeah.
But and to speak sincerely, I was very appreciative of my homeschool experience because mm-hmm. a homeschool experience allows you to graduate early, mm-hmm. go ahead and pursue college pretty early on. And so that was the benefit for me of being homeschooled. But yeah, we were a very different breed. Very different breed.
Yeah. I was homeschooled too in a similar era until mm-hmm. seventh grade, and then it was kind of, you don't realize how weird you are until later.
Yes.
And you're like,
yes.
Oh.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm that kind of weird.
Yes.
And later
everybody
on, you just
singing songs.
Yeah. You just mm-hmm. try to blend later. You're like, oh boy, I hope I can blend.
Yes. Yes.
Just like, whoops. But it is, it does teach you, I think, how to be, to not think in a conformist way and to think much
right.
more creatively because you've never had to think about conforming. Your family was
yeah.
it. And so I think it's actually an advantage, but you do get smacked up with reality later. You're like, oh, wow.
Absolutely.
but it's
absolutely.
too late to undo that. But I think it is. It's a but then
you're so right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, there's no one doing that. But yeah, and so now as you teach, do you teach in the public school system?
I do. Mm. I do.
Right in Dallas,
yes.
Like in a rural environment or like a city environment?
It is a city environment, a very heavy populated city, right on the outskirts of Dallas, but it's in what we call the DFW Metroplex. I teach in a city called, so it's the ISD, and this is my first year to teach. Well, I'm going into my second year to teach seventh grade, but previously I've always taught eighth grade, and not a very big difference. It's that middle school, you know, mm-hmm. middle school age where mm-hmm. I actually love it because they're at that crux of, who am I? I still love Legos, but I feel like I'm supposed to now go ahead and transition to get ready for high school. And so mm-hmm. I think I'm supposed to like rated R movies, but I really like Madagascar and Tom and Jerry. And so I'm still struggling with, I like a coloring book, but I think I should be looking at older magazines. And so just, I love being in that middle phase to be able to say, you don't have to let someone determine who you are. What do you like? What mm-hmm. is your passion?
Mm-hmm. I just want to say, you know, I really like to teach my students, you know, don't give someone else the pen to write the story of your life. You go ahead and decide who you want to be.
Mm. Yeah. And that's a really interesting point because there's a lot of, role models and in pop culture and mm-hmm. it's hard mm-hmm. to know who you are if you're just looking around in the media or something like that. It's hard to know, like, who am I? Who do I want to be? Like, what do I really like? Or am I just being shown by, you know,
absolutely
who to be and then who to pattern myself after? And, you know, mm-hmm. I think that's just a typical teenager thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really take a good inventory sometimes unless you're encouraged to do that.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And do you bring in your poetry and the do you encourage that among your students, that type of thing?
I do. In fact, for 2 years in a row, when I taught at the eighth grade level, the eighth grade level, that's a big poetry unit that we actually delve into and learn the famous poets, whether deceased or still existing. And at some point, the students are very shocked when I say, okay, for the next 3 weeks, you know, we're going to close the textbooks, and I'm going to ask you to express who you are in a poem. And they look at me like, you are joking. You have got to be kidding. Mm. I mean, Miss, we appreciate what you've been teaching us, but I can't rhyme. And so, you know, we start off with some free verse poetry. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to rhyme. You know, I say, I just want four lines. Your work is to give me four lines. Talk about your dog. Talk about the cafeteria food. Talk about, you know, a video game. Talk about your younger brother, you know, and they come back in. And it happens every year. I just say, okay, drop off your homework. And they say, no, we want to read it in class. And that's my goal.
Mm.
That's my goal every year, is for them to go ahead and say, I want to perform this. And so every year I take candles, we dim the lights, you know, we play some background music, and they just fully engage in releasing to their classmates who they really are and who they really want to be. And we always spend about 3 or 4 days with them writing a eulogy for someone that they miss, you know, and so that they get to honor someone that they love. And there are always tears. There's always a very cathartic release. But that's what I want them to understand, is poetry is great and it's hype, but it's also very therapeutic.
Well, that brings me to something that is, maybe you'll see the natural segue. And of course, Dallas has been in the news with the slayings recently. And of course, there's a lot of upheaval and racial tension in the United States right now. And the arts play such an important role, I think, in this. You probably would agree.
And, absolutely.
And just with cathartic, you know, in terms of being a cathartic release, but also in bringing people together and cutting through a lot of things, building bridges and unifying people, as well as just helping us see our humanity.
Yeah.
And, you know, how's this whole time been for you, and how do you see it playing out in your own art?
This whole time has, that's a big question.
Yeah, sure is. Yeah. Answer in two sentences. No, I'm just, I mean, I realize this is going to be one of those ongoing things that you'll be processing for a long time.
Absolutely.
And I mean, whatever you can say on it, it's obviously, well, I might have to come back and check later, and we'll do a follow up and see where things have gone too. But, Since you live, I didn't know you lived in Dallas. For some reason, I was still thinking Chicago. I think it's because of Tammy. And then I'm like, and you're saying Dallas. And I'm like, oh, that's right.
Yes.
So this is like a surprise for me. And I thought, well, man, just with the poetry and the grieving and the racial stuff, the racial tensions and the injustice and there's just so much there. And everybody's unpacking it. But people in the arts, I think, this is the time to shine.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm. And well said. I do live in Dallas. Like I said, born and raised there. And so it's, you know, it's shocking when you see it unfold. It's shocking and devastating enough when you see it unfold in the densely populated cities. And we see it, you know, broadcast on the news. But now it's in my backyard. And it's right here. And the night that all of the turmoil unpacked itself in the streets of downtown Dallas, I have two neighbors that I grew up with who we call them our, you know, play brother and play sister. And they're both police officers. And they were there. And that entire night, they kept texting my family saying, please stop praying. Like, please don't. Getting texts round the clock with them just saying, you know, it's crazy down here. It's absolutely crazy. And so it's, you know, as an African-American young lady, it's very, very unnerving, very unsettling. And I'm not landed in my thoughts. It has produced a poem because it produces grief. And my relationship with the Lord is that he holds my hand in grief, and it turned into a rhyme, you know. And so A poem has come from that, but, you know, all of my thoughts are not landed. And, you know, I'll be honest, I don't I don't know if they will land because mm-hmm. this is not the end. People are still unsettled.
Yeah.
And so there is a difference between, I heard someone say there is a difference between order and justice. A lot of us want things to get back to order, but nothing will get back to order without justice.
Yes, yes. And it's hard to, I mean, it's hard for humans to be just. There's so mm-hmm. much that plays into that. There's right. so much systemic injustice that mm-hmm. with systems that are set up wrong in the first place, that it's, you know, even right. people's best intentions sometimes can't get there. And so it's like, I think mm-hmm. a lot of people looking mm-hmm. on even are kind of like, yike, what do we do? Like, how do we get there from right. here? And yeah. that's why I think the arts, they don't answer all the questions, but they kind of can at least shed light on in the first place. But then after that, kind of, there's lots of things, obviously, the arts can do, bring healing and bring like yeah. a salve to
yeah.
an oil and wine to heal those wounds. But also like just bind the wounds and like allow us to kind of cry together in like a communal lament.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe take a step forward together in the right direction. But it's not like, okay, and we're done. Like, now the problem's solved. You know, like, I mean, correct. I wish, but I don't know that anybody knows, like, how you fix it. But I think if we can, for some reason, well, it's also because I'm creative and I'm artistically bent, that I find that cuts through a lot of things that rhetoric never does, that laws never do. You can right. pile a lot of laws on the law books, but art changes people's hearts.
Absolutely.
And of course the love of Christ changes people's hearts, and art is absolutely. You know, art and the spiritual world, and that's all to me tied together. Like that is mm-hmm. on some other deeper, more, I don't know, more human level or more like root level. And so mm-hmm. It's kind of all tied up there in a ball at some other level. And so I imagine that your work will touch on pieces of that as you process mm. through all of it. But it's so big that mm-hmm. and it's, you know, it just involves so many just hard, messy things that
yeah.
But since you were talking about grief and poetry and you eulogizing, mm-hmm. I thought I have to get your take on things, because mm-hmm. you're right there in it. You're right there at kind of ground zero, and I'm just interested yeah. to know.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then maybe in the future we can revisit some of that if you ever want to speak again on those topics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would love that. I really would.
Mm-hmm. And does your poetry, you do talk about race relations and things like that in your poetry, social justice issues as well, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And have you been asked to perform those pieces around the country?
I have performed this. There's a piece sitting right here in front of me. It was one that you referenced earlier. And I did perform this, in fact, last summer, twice in the DF Metroplex, as a way of saying, how can we be healed together? Mm. And how can we use the arts to do that? Because last summer, Ground Zero was not here in Dallas. Ground Zero was in several other, you know, big cities.
Yeah.
And it was on surfacing across, you know, United States landscape. And so
mm-hmm.
we spent about 2 months just putting our hands together, you know, several different ethnicities. And we just, you know, just got together and said, what can we do as a response? And so we decided, let's have some nights of artistry to just allow people to jot down their thoughts, whether it's in rhyme scheme or not. Maybe, you know, maybe it's in a rap, maybe it's in a song. And so I did get to perform a poetry piece called In Memoriam of Morality / End Quote. And I was able to perform that just as a way to shake up what we might think is normal, mm-hmm. and to also invite back what should be normal.
Mm. Yeah, would you be able to read it now?
Yes.
Thank you.
So this is In Memoriam of Morality, end quote. You know, it's hard to look for a good laugh when so many of our channels expose the madness of what seems to be consistent harassment of what some... Well, that might be stuck or unable to label true stories or fables, either over dinner or all too often under the table, dealing with people who... Well, that might make things sticky. When only hearing one side sure make things iffy, so we are left with tricky. How do you converse and talk about videos and uploads from people on their walkabout and driveabout showing millions and millions what to gasp about? Because honestly, to see so many videos about, well, what is race? And is that the question? Or what is racism? And is that the conglomeration of too many swirling in one population with too many nationalities, ethnicities in several locations? Again, is that the question? I mean, I watch videos of these recent incidents, and no lie, I felt completely absent from joy, completely different from indifference, but also distant from revenge or payback. I honestly felt more under attack, not from a cup, seeing something within every human. And because we are fallen, we lack the courage to say what C.S. Lewis so eloquently expressed. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. End quote. Isn't that utterly ridiculous? And even senseless, but older friends, he is speaking to our present day existence. We take Jesus out of schools and are stupid enough to demand and look for values. We sanction abortion, but lock up thieves. We hooray same-sex marriages while little boys and little girls struggle with identity. We laugh and mock politicians, but stay out of the polls. And then when we turn on the TV, we have the audacity to ask, what is going on? So is that the question? I mean, what channel should I watch just to get away from the madness? What channel can I view to escape the harassment? To be honest, friends, when I watch these videos again and again, I fall to my knees in repentance because I start to see color when I see brutality. I start to see race when I see crimes against humanity. And I only feel that way when I lack the courage to say these words from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Judging others makes us blind, whereas love is illuminating, end quote. Then no wonder we can't see. Our judgments create us burning down cities, and we wrestle all night wondering who and what color will be the victim of our fights, like two wrongs ever made of. Mother Teresa smiled and said, God will ask, how much love did you put into what you did, end quote. Is that the question? That question, my friends, will expose the reality in our hearts as we 60 mile an hour cast bricks through windows, hoping that will cover up the grief and anger in our soul. And so we submit to temporary exhilarations, contributing to an ongoing deviation of how not to deal with the systemic situation as we watch those bricks shatter bank accounts. But do we even take into account the morning after the one night stand when fumes consume the inability to resume the life we presumed or desired? And I have a question, because I can't put out this fire. How do unjust deaths lead to grocery buggies with flat screen TVs, car trunks with microwaves and DVD players? Yeah, I'm a hater. What are we doing and what have we done? We're teaching a younger generation that sin has a color and revenge is the other route to avenge, and we're letting them grow up with another lie. Why are we quiet? If we choose to send a message of silence, we are inevitably advocating the violence. It's hard to see through the anger in our hearts. The unforgiveness in our carts, add to cart the grudges in our cart, add to cart the vindictive actions that tasted sweet, only backwash tart, add to cart. Check out? Heck no. Some of us need to check in and ask yet again, what is the question? What can we do to get away from this stench, sin, covered in revenge, covered in avenge, and death? Our plight had us fight against skin, but the only fight is the one against sin. But how do you fight a force you can't grab? You can't choke. Is that why we burn down buildings? Because at least with smoke, we see the ruin of our own demise. And yet, even when I close my eyes, I can't shut out the images inside. I've already seen them, the punches, the chokeholds, the funeral. And in the last days, get ready for more turmoil. All men sin and fall short. That's nothing new to report. Except with that terse verse, feel free to rehearse your own shortcomings. May not have involved a chokehold or a gun, but a sin is a sin. And in the end, we all desperately need repentance. Don't we? Isn't that the question? End quote.
There's a lot there. There's a lot there. I was going to say, let's talk about it. And then I thought, oh my.
There is a lot there.
And it's really, when you leave those sentences that are undone, it's like really, really jarring at first. And you're just left like with so much angst. In the beginning there, you know, and just just exactly like those situations become, just like these horrible situations are in the news, you're left with all that same sorts of feelings, of pain and unresolved feelings, and your poem is probably even more powerful in the wake of the new summer tragedies that have happened. I think it's, you know, it's even more poignant now, perhaps.
It's even more poignant because, you know, protests, Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter protests, you know, taken out of a remnants of civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And yet all of those remnants have not come into the Black Lives Matter movement, all of those remnants out of the civil rights movement, such as turn the other cheek. Love can only conquer hate. Hate cannot conquer hate. Only love can do that. And so even out of the Martin Luther King era remnants coming out of the New Testament, turn the other cheek. And yet we don't see those remnants bleeding and infiltrating and inundating this movement when it turns into violence, when it turns into sniper actions, when it turns into looting. And so I'm African American, but I cannot lean back and justify hate trying to overcome hate. I cannot justify not turning the other cheek. And so when I grieve and when I cry, it's crying out of, you know, ill-timed murders. It's crying out of ill-timed deaths, but it's also crying out of, I wish, you know, the Black community would say, wait, before we do that, does that even make sense? Looting and rioting, or or before a non-Black person passes judgment, it's what will this do for the betterment of humanity? And so there's an anger in me, and there's also a sadness in me. And then there's a solace in me, and then there's also this righteous wrath that wants to scream out and say, and how will this better the humanity? You know, whether they are a believer or not.
Right. Yeah, and it's such a tough problem, because I can see, this is the dilemma, is that I can see why people are so justified to be so upset and so hateful and want to take revenge. I totally get it, and I feel like, you know what, you almost feel like, well, yeah, I understand why. Revenge would be so seductive. I totally get it, because I've seen the videos, I've seen the murders, and I get why that would be so, you'd be so incensed as to want to do it back. And yet, of course, that never works, you know. And the call as Christians, and I think is that strange upside down kingdom thing where we're supposed to conquer with love, and that seems so backward.
Yeah.
And yet it is the thing that wins because it's the only thing that puts the fire out.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like if you advocate that, then you're saying give up and let the oppressor win.
Right.
You know, it seems like you're saying that, but you know, the oppressor should be confronted. The oppressor should be
absolutely.
You know, it should be put down. You know, and mm-hmm. I guess I'm from. So my background is my dad was Puerto Rican. He passed away, but he was dark. He was dark. I like to say he was darker than Obama, just to surprise people. So I have a mixed background. My parents, my grandparents on my dad's side were very dark, fluent in Spanish, but I take after my mom very light. Nobody suspects I'm like a double agent, you know. So I've witnessed people being very prejudiced because of my dad's dark skin, but and treat him badly. A scout leader wouldn't not let him be a Boy Scout because it was just an ethnic thing,
yeah.
You know, like you can't be in our club, and stuff like that. So it's not like I have had this experience of having dark skin myself, but I've noticed that I wasn't treated the same way as people in my family because of how I looked. And so I know that there's a thing. I know that's not a fake thing. Because I've seen it for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that people who, I guess I would just like to ask you, what do you think people who have light skin, what do you think is their responsibility to do to help change the way things are going, to make the situation better?
I love that question. I think I told you that I'm the fourth of eight children, and two of my siblings, several siblings are married, but two of my siblings are actually married to white people. And so it's been interesting because I think one way to say, well, what can a light person do, or what can a not so dark skinned person do? Mm-hmm. I think the best thing to do is to engage in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly do. Of course, it would be great if we said something like, well, we think you should go to your congressman and you should write your senator. But I honestly think the first thing to do is start that conversation and talk about that elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, well, you know, when you're driving down a dark alley, would you be afraid if you were pulled over? Or if you were in a store and if you felt like you were watched, how would that feel? And to even talk about, do you feel like there's more privilege in one color than another?
Mm.
And if you were wearing my shoes, how do you feel? Do you feel like you would lose privilege? Or even, you know, to be in all honesty, you know, the gender biases, you know, okay, you're my brother-in-law, but so do you feel like you have more privilege, you know, you're a man. And so I think it's just, I really do think it's just having a conversation. And then from that conversation, inviting more people to have a conversation, because I feel like perhaps the roots of ignorance might be the volume of silence.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've been more polarized, or at least it just appears that we've been more polarized, that maybe because of how the media works now and algorithms and Facebook and stuff, that you wind up getting this confirmation bias of being with your own people who think the same way as you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always surprised at, I have a really diverse group of connections and friendships of people who are really far left, really far right, and I don't know if that just makes me a weirdo. I don't even know. Probably. I'm thinking that's what it is. And I'm always surprised when people say things like, weird things to me, really odd, like white privilege isn't a thing. And I'm thinking, are you, what? Like,
well, you
must have it then, because what do you mean? Like, and just things like I would take for granted, they'd be clueless about. And so I think that you're right. The conversation to just say, well, why would you think that's true?
Right.
And just not in an aggressive, I don't think in an aggressive way would help, but just to,
absolutely.
Why do you think that? What would make you think that? What if I told you a story? What if I just, you know, telling your own story? And like people will be surprised when I tell them stories about my family and stories about my poppy coming to the United States and not speaking English and what he had to go through. Stuff like that. Just real life, you know, human stories. And when people see that it's not just an ideology, it's actually there's people behind those stories.
Right.
And that you know, and the United States is a really mixed place than it was 30 years ago. Like you're saying, your relatives, so you have relatives that are interracially, if that's a thing.
Right.
I'm always thinking, like, what makes you not race anymore? Like, my kids are like, are they 1/4 Puerto Rican? Is that a thing? Like, I was like, trying to think. Like, I was telling my son has some learning disabilities, and he came home and he wound up saying to this kid that he was Puerto Rican, and the aides at school said, oh honey, no, you're not, because they thought, poor kid, he has a learning disability, poor kid thinks he's Puerto Rican because he doesn't look a thing, you know, he looks as Anglo as, but he knew that he was, because he knew that I'm born in Puerto Rico and my dad you know, had to have my maiden name's Puerto Rican. And he goes, well, what am I? I said, well, you are, honey, but, you know, you're a little bit, you know. So I was trying to, you know, it gets confusing. We're mixed.
Yeah.
A lot of us are mixed. And and so most people are, if they look back, it's not as simple as you think. You know, if you really look back in your family tree, I think a lot of people will be surprised. So,
I agree. I completely agree with you.
So I think that, you know, being honest about, probably not everybody knows their background as much as they think, for one thing, but also just having the conversations and making sure that and this is my opinion, but I'd love for you to weigh in too, is making sure that the friends and connections you have are very, very diverse.
Absolutely.
And that you don't have a group of friends that looks just one way, is from just one background and just one way of life. Because you really close yourself off to ideas and to people who see the world differently, of their heritage is different. They've experienced so much different things in life.
Absolutely. And I love what you're saying, and I'm in complete 100% agreement with it, with diversity. I just feel like that makes us stronger. That's supposed to be, you know, that's the American dream, is strength and diversity. And so one of our downfalls is when we don't appreciate that diversity and that strength, and then it completely exposes our fallenness. And because we were, as God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit were created in, you know, community and relationship, and that's supposed to be what we thrive for, and that's in our DNA, is for relationship and community. And so when we reject that idea and that notion of who we are, all it does is it cripples us. And then what we have, the louder voices, like you referenced earlier about, like, how a lot of this is exposed through, like, our social media. But what is so sad is that typically those loudest voices are the ones that are not speaking for the majority. And so the ones who have a better idea are typically a little more silent. And so, you know, it kind of stays in those small pockets when it needs to be really exposed to the entire zip code, of, you know, let's have this big conversation. Let's talk about what doesn't feel good.
Yeah, the least wise people are the loudest, right?
Absolutely, yes.
How do we get an algorithm for that?
Yeah, conversation.
Yes. Oh my goodness. And so as you think about the new school year coming, coming upon you, and kids coming back and dealing with your diversity at school, and maybe some of the baggage from the summer coming up, and there might be more things to deal with, and you'll be
Oh yeah.
You know, there'll be students coming in and they'll have probably a lot of questions and things to deal with. You think that the arts will be a way to deal with that, and how do you think you're gonna make any adjustments to deal with some of the things that have happened over the summer?
I love the fact that I do have that type of autonomy and permission to weave in the events from the summer and even last summer. And even when we talk about overseas and our refugees and things like that, we do have opportunity to weave that in to our learning, because my students know me very well. They know that it is not always just textbook learning, but it's, okay, now how are you going to take what you just read and take that back to your zip code and take that back to your neighborhood? Mm-hmm. It's great to say, Miss, we should learn how to forgive one another, or we should learn how to accept one another. Okay, thank you for saying that in the context of this classroom. But now, when you go back to your home, how is that going to play out when your neighbor doesn't like what you just said? Because you can't start a fight right here in this classroom, but how are you going to take that same strength to be humble and that same strength to hear someone out and allow them to continue talking so you can give them pushback and feedback and pushback and feedback? And I don't like running from controversy in my classroom. I embrace it and I accept it. And a lot of times my students say, you should start teaching history, because it's not all, they tell me that every single year. Reading teacher, you're a history teacher. Because I cannot help but weave in, we become a better society when we stop reproducing those same mistakes. Mm-hmm. What are we different?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Well, are there any resources beyond, we'll get to like where people can find you and stuff like that, but are there any resources for people who are interested in getting into poetry a little bit more, or that resources that have been inspirational for you as you've delved into this?
I think the greatest resources might be to Google. I mean, it might sound strange, but I mean, Google was pre-Anita. Anita was pre-Google. Like, you know, Google is now absolutely populated. But when I was young, I continually was at the library, and I was always grabbing, Nikki Giovanni, Langston Hughes, because I felt like they stepped outside of what I considered to be traditional poetry. And so for those who feel like they have an ear bent toward arts in the venue of poetry, I would say, align yourself with the poet that you feel like, you know what, that's what I've been wanting to do free verse for so long, and I found a poet who does it. Or I've been wanting to do poetry without punctuation for so long, and I found Nikki Giovanni, who absolutely hates punctuation. or I found Langston Hughes, who is bringing social justice to the platform. Or, you know, honestly, singers, Otis Redding, Curtis Mayfield, Marvin Gaye, these are singers who were not afraid to talk about their situations of, you know, social injustices of their day, and they just song. So I would just tell people to find the poet that you gel with, and there's a poet that can gel with anybody. And at the same time, go ahead and start saying, wow, I'm going to practice putting my tears or my joy or nature, my love of nature, to poetry. I'm just going to try to rhyme it.
Not be too hard and too critiquing of yourself as you just get into it. And
just get into it. Mess up, scratch through it, chicken scratch. And keep those papers, though. Like, don't throw it away. Just see the progression of, this is what I thought I was going to say, but this is the end product. Wow, I've journeyed. So, I mean, some poems take years to write, and I really mean that. They take months to write. They just keep evolving and evolving. So keep all your chicken stretch and just love it. Enjoy it.
Oh, you are such a delight. I love you, Anita.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. Love right back.
So I know you're getting a website going, and I'm wondering where people can find you. Where's the best spot?
Okay. The best spot would be to a couple of options. Top Poet, Anita Scott, poetanitascott.wordpress.com. And that's, I'll say it again, poetanitascott.wordpress.com. And that site is extremely new, and is as poetry is evolving all the time, this site is evolving all the time, because we are wanting to constantly upload videos and YouTubes. And another place to find me would be mudroomblog.com. And they can find me on there. And again, that site, I'm a part of a phenomenal group of ladies. Sometimes I'm extremely humbled that they let me be a part of this, but this is what you were referencing earlier about me being a resident. And so I'm extremely humbled to be a part of this real, organic, messy community. Messy because we just give each other permission to be ourselves. But that is where people can find me. They can find me if they type in Anita Scott YouTube. And so we are just working to condense all of my footprints and make it one big digital footprint to find me. But those are some places to track down Anita Scott.
And I do encourage people to see Anita perform, because she's animated and it adds this whole different dimension to the work, because there's something performative about slam poetry that is just a whole different animal than just hearing a reading. It's just kind of like, you know, it's part of the fun of it. It's part of the joy of it. And that's what I love about the whole art form is really enjoyable, I think. So I'm going to have links to that. And then as you populate your WordPress, they'll get more and more things on there, and I'll update the links as needed on the show notes. And
absolutely.
And if you could close us out with a poem, that would be so cool.
Awesome. I would love to do that. This poem is called Bellows. Be the bellow of my soul. Be the bellow in my soul. Be the push and the blow that reconciles gaining with letting go. Releasing while receiving. Be the reason that hope lives in tears. Be the one who steers the rudder of my soul. Especially when the waves crash up against the sea. When I cry out like another one of your disciples, Jesus, are you still with me? And shake my head in anguish, because what I thought I knew has begun to panic, because the rug I thought was magic was really only compounding static, moving but lacking in purpose. So much of what I thought I knew was just white noise rehearsing to solicit my days and my attention and blind my gaze and my vision so I could look. But I couldn't see, not with so many lies staring back at me. The road was bleak, but I couldn't even tell. My eyes were weak, like under a spell. But then you bellowed, and the attachment to lies not only mellowed, but ceased really fast. And I quickly turned my gaze to the one who will last. And then you bellowed. And my walls fell down, and I prayed prayers I had been afraid to utter. But this time when I prayed, I bellowed them loudly, even with a stutter. But you let me know that that didn't matter, because I had finally opened up the shutter of my heart that had been so reclusive. And all I wanted to give you was access that was inclusive. I no longer wanted to pretend you hadn't seen my mess, but not just seen it. You were it. That cross that you carried was when you bore it. So why was I pretending I needed to hide and store it? I take a Selah and a lean back. I rest my chin and my hands to a future flashback. That's how you've won me. I was yours before I was here. You saw me even before I could see clear. Talk about a dead man walking. I was dead, while acting alive, and that's when you chose to die for me. Check out Romans 5. You didn't give up your life when I surrendered mine. You sacrificed yours even when I acted like things were just fine. You saw a mess and fell in love. I felt love and decided to run. You saw me and said, ah, my bride. I saw you and chose to hide. You saw love, I screamed in fear. You saw marriage, I drew tears. Because your closeness was just so much. I didn't think I was worthy of such unconditional love and affection. Not with my blatant attempt to turn our marriage into separation. But you thought of that too. Deciding that neither death nor life could separate me from you. Check out Romans 8:32. And then you bellowed and stole my heart from senseless attractions. You bellowed, and now I'm wondering what took me so long to give you all of my satisfaction. You bellowed and blew life into me. You bellowed, and it's only by your breath that I can give you my heart so sincerely.
That is inspired. That is just, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, that's like a breath of life. Oh, man, I can't thank you enough, Anita. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.